Small Business and Startup Stories DSM features conversations with small business owners who share both their victories and failures on their path to success. Small Business and Startup Stories DSM is produced by the Greater Des Moines Partnership. More tips and resources are available at dsmpartnership.com/smallbusiness. I'm your host, Mike Caldwell.
Todd Krohn and Jason Cope, welcome back to Startup Stories. If you would, bring us up to speed on PowerPod. Where does the company stand today?
Sure. So like any startup, I think, you know, we're behind on our forecasts, right? I'll tell you, we have validated the business model. We've shown that our core technology, which is pollen preservation, works at commercial levels. We've got patents granted. So that's great progress, right where we wanted to be. For pollen collection, we've shown that that's working at commercial levels. But then one aspect on the technical side, pollen application, isn't working as consistently as we wanted it, which has really caused, even though we've commercialized our technology, it has caused the ramp up not to be as fast, the adoption rate to slow down, which means, you know, we're behind probably from original forecast of profitability by several years, but a more recent forecast, we're already behind by a year. And I think that's the norm in the startup world. That's part of what we'll talk about today, change. But yeah, that's where we're at.
You know, some of it makes sense as well when you look at the process, really. First, we had to figure out if we could preserve pollen, and then we focused really on collecting enough pollen to make it substantial enough to use commercially. And really, this last step of optimizing the applicators fits the steps in the process. And, you know, the other aspect of really where we're at today that I think is a real pleasant surprise is the number of seed companies that we're working with. When you start a startup, you really hope to land some big customers and land any sort of customer, big, small, medium. And at this point, we're working with the majority of seed producers in industry. So I think that's a pleasant surprise that validates the progress that we've made in the technology.
Yeah, it seems like from what I know, those large companies have been very, I guess I'd say very willing to accept the fact that it's not going as fast as it's going as you want it to go. And we all want things to go faster. And yes, everything takes twice as long and costs three times as much. That's the old saw. But when your customers are willing to stand by you and say, you know, let's go fix this and maybe even help, that's probably one of the best validations of a market you can ever get.
Yeah, I agree. We have, you know, it all comes back to expectations, right? And we have one customer that has tried to do this before, and they are very happy with where we're at and are doing exactly what you said, Mike, coming alongside and using the words we and these we have, and we'll get this, we'll convince our internal stakeholders. So it's absolutely, we have that partnership developed with many companies.
So take us back a little bit when you started Power Pollen. What year did you two start working on the concept? And then what year did it actually become a company and start being real?
So we actually had a fairly compressed timeline there. And I think I would say both Todd and I had thoughts about pollen prior to starting Power Pollen. That go back to even early stages in both of our careers. But we formed the company in March of 2015, and we really sort of hit the ground running. Of course, funding at that time was, we were absent of it. We were funded out of our own pockets until we did some early raises. But during the summer of 2015, we were out there validating some of our concepts. And of course, at that time, we didn't have the ability to preserve pollen. So we were doing things like fooling the plants to think it was daytime when it was night so we could collect pollen and race it out to the field before the natural pollen shed came. And we've just made advancements year over year that have really helped further the technology.
And like many big ideas, you know, the first seeds for me were in 1996, 95, actually. In a postdoc I was in, where someone was kind of trying to preserve pollen. And then there was a patent issued in 97, I believe it was, that Jason and I, when he mentioned in our careers, we thought about it. We both talked about that patent in the early 2000s. And boy, what could you do? You know, but most of the ideas for the patents we got weren't until we really were able to focus just on this in 2015 and 16. And everything just started gelling and coming together. So there's something to be said for just focus, full-time focus on a problem.
Well, I also think, if I can jump in on that one a little bit, I think that you guys came to Power Pollen with a lot of experience, not only in business, but in technology. You both have, if I'm not mistaken, you both have PhDs. You both have been involved in this industry in a very technical, or at least around a very technical subject for a lot of years. So you came to as subject matter experts. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I actually have a bachelor's degree, but a long time focus in ag. This is what I've done ever since I got out of school. Never saw myself in ag once I graduated college, but gosh, once I started in this industry, it's captured my attention and it's going to be a lifelong pursuit.
I came in as a subject matter expert in corn genetics and somewhat seed production. I wasn't a physiological expert in pollen preservation or the physiology of reproduction. But I knew, because I was a geneticist, I knew all the things we could do if we had that. So we hired a person right away who did have that physiological expertise, which he did much of the foundational work for the patents. So we each had our own piece that we brought in.
Well, and I wonder sometimes, maybe you did experience this, but sometimes by not having the core knowledge, you're willing to question things and try things that people that own the core, well, that live the core knowledge and have been taught the core knowledge would never think to try.
Yeah, I think that's true, Mike. And I know one of the things in the very first startup story that we had discussed was some of the things that people in industry label as impossible, they're great opportunities because, you know, people aren't focusing on solving that issue. They've really dismissed it as something that can't be solved through science or through technology. And pollen preservation was really a good example of that. It's something people have attempted to do for, if you look at the scientific literature, over 100 years, and nobody has been able to do it at a really scaled and stable level until now.
Interesting. Reminds me of Tesla. I mean, you guys don't make electric cars, but how many people said electric cars couldn't be done, right? And batteries would never get far
enough. That's for sure.
I was in the battery industry tangentially in the early 90s when lithium ion came out, and all the naysayers were there. So no big surprise. So you say that you talk about the core problem being, if I remember right, the early stages was, can we collect and preserve pollen? The preservation was really the key piece to it. And I'm curious now, as you look at the business today and going forward, how is that evolved? Is it a broader look? You talk about collection and application, but does it get even broader than that now that you have some of these foundational things relatively sorted out?
Yeah, it does get broader. And I guess I would back up and say the core problem that Jason and I really thought about coming out of the gate was a 100-year-old seed production process for corn. It was very inefficient. And secondly, wheat. Wheat was on our radar. Wheat was on my radar, and I think Jason's too, before corn. Wheat, you can't even make hybrid seed cost effectively. There are some companies doing it, but for the most part, it's really not possible. So the problem was, everyone knows you can make hybrid seed, you get more yield. The problem was you couldn't make hybrid seed in wheat, and in corn it was inefficient and expensive. And the solution was indeed pollen preservation. So that core solution is still the core to all of the future value points as well. So I would say what's evolved is we realized once we got into it that the corn grain market could benefit from this as well. So maybe I'll back up. Seed is the seed company's product. They sell to the farmer. The farmer grows the seed and then sells the grain to the elevator to a feed lot. And the same solution can improve grain as well by giving traits that can't come in otherwise, value-added traits like high oil, or just increasing yield in general. And so the pivot, pivot's not the right word, the evolution is that we realized it's not hard to improve this technology just a little bit more, and it will be applicable to corn grain as well. And corn grain has 450 million acres worldwide, where seed only has 3 to 4 million acres.
So if I look at it from a consumer side, the supply chain looks like seed corn gets planted by farmers to create feed corn, if you will, to feed to an animal, which is then creates the meat supply for the consumer. So you really kind of started at the top of the, or at the beginning of the supply chain and are working your way out and finding benefits. And of course, like you say, a couple million acres of seed becomes almost a half billion acres of planted grain, corn grain. That's a bigger number. You also really do want to have your application process nailed by the time you tackle that much space. So.
It's a great example, though, of we really chose seed production in corn for two reasons. One, we were most familiar with corn. And two, we knew there was a great opportunity for return on investment just because it's a fairly costly system that's has a lot of issues within it. And the core attributes of collecting, preserving, and applying pollen certainly apply across the board, whether you're looking at rice, wheat, corn, so many crops that biological reproduction is, just imperative to achieve stability in the product. And so that's why we're finding that even though our eye's still on the ball for scaling this seed production to the different seed companies, that there are so many other revenue generating opportunities. It's really fun to be a part of.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about, and it's a great point for others that you didn't choose the biggest market or the most in need. Maybe I could say that if you say wheat, we can't even economically hybridize wheat. But you chose the one that would probably give you the earliest success and earliest return so you could build a deeper foundation of your company. I think that's something a lot of startups miss. They go for the big win. It's kind of like going up the plate wanting to hit home runs all the time. It doesn't always work. I'd like to just keep going on that. And let's talk a little bit deeper on the change of direction power pollen and other startups go through. And it really gets around how a company talks, how you work through and manage everything from customer feedback to industry feedback to, let's face it, legislative pressures, science progress or pushback from science and other influence that like investors that influence the direction of your company. How do you two handle that?
Yeah, so we always go back to what are our objectives? What are we trying to do? And we have one, you ask about, we thought a lot about mentors and advisors. We have one person on our board who always says, there's only one number one. And I usually say back to him, maybe there's two, but there's not more than two. I do think sometimes there's two number ones. And he almost always, if you ask anyone in a company, they should know one of those two. And hopefully they know one that they're most concerned about. When you do that and you start to decipher, as you said, the industry and put the customer feedback, legislative pressure, not a lot there, regulatory side of things, not a lot for us. And you start to look at the science progress. The logic and rationale just kind of falls together of what you should be doing. Where should you be spending your time? It becomes pretty clear. Kind of starts the logical fall, the dominoes of logic to say, here's what we should be working on. And you process that with customers and you find out how they define success. Make sure you're in line. It's a lot of communication. And in this day of COVID, that's obviously harder when you can't be face to face. But the logical dominoes start to fall. And one thing we've started to do that I think is helpful, Jason might disagree on this, but I learned this from Jeff, an article from Jeff Bezos, that what he did is before a meeting, someone had to write a memo on the topic to say, here's the background of what we're going to talk about. So everyone comes in prepared. And if you didn't read, you don't talk at the meeting. And everyone's prepared, comes in, and the memo was basically a rationale of how we get to a decision point or strategy. And we've been doing that probably 6 months now, that exact process. And it's this, it's that type of thing that I think helps you balance all of these things. So
I would agree with that, Todd. And I would also say sometimes you have to make people a little bit uncomfortable. It's easy to fall into these daily routines of what you do when you get to the office and how you conduct your daily business. And this memo, I hadn't read the article, but this memo initiative has been, I think, a nice efficiency increase for our particular leadership team meetings and really just people's awareness coming in and out of those meetings.
Well, I think it helps with the focus of a meeting for someone who ended up in a company that grew very, very large. At one time, we had almost 5,000 employees. Keeping focus in the meeting is hard. And I appreciate what Bezos has put forth. And I don't know if he innovated that or borrowed it, but it doesn't really matter. But it, you know, we get lost in our PowerPoint slides and our graphics and our videos. And there's nothing wrong with all that stuff. But, you know, I guess maybe I'm a little old school. I want to see the numbers, right? I want to understand. And I think that it also, one of the things I think he's written about is that it brings the quieter people in the room out, because they come in on a more even keel. And a lot of people who are more introverted tend to want to really understand something before they just speak out, versus the extrovert and says, I think we should do this, you know, and jumps right in there and kind of dominates the room. And it really helps control the domination of the room. And it shortens meetings.
Another thing it does shorten meetings is I've had a really hard time getting those. Like, we have different people write a different memo each week of the topic. And I've had a hard time getting them. I tell them, you don't have to come in and say anything. I mean, you may want to highlight the bottom line, but we've all read it. It's us to ask questions and then get to your decision point. And impossible for all of us sometimes not to give the big speech at the beginning and where we're going and talk for 10 or 15 or longer minutes. This has just helped to be like, okay, you don't have to say anything. Here's the question I have, you know, it's been, I think it's been really good.
Yeah. I have used it a couple of times myself with a group of people outside of my own organization and found it very effective in moving, especially when I was trying it with a new idea, trying to move, throw a new idea on the table and move it forward. And it was fairly effective. Yeah. So you talked a bit about your mentor, your one mentor. How have mentors affected your journey through the startup world?
You know, for us, Mike, mentors have been a really critical ingredient in the process. And I don't think you realize initially when you go to form a startup, especially when it's your first startup, just how much core knowledge you need to, things you don't know, how quickly you need to figure out answers to that. And whether it be through startup veterans, business advisors, financial advisors, city, county, and state initiatives and programs, and supportive family members is also a key, because the startup journey is not an easy one, and you really have to have your family support as you're putting in long hours and really doing some sometimes backbreaking work. We wouldn't be where we are today without the many mentors that have helped us through this process. And I think that's a real key that you have to recognize early on in a startup is the things you don't know. It's not about necessarily going out and learning those. It's about finding someone who can teach you and using their expertise and trusting their expertise. And they're out there. There are a lot of mentors out there that are willing to freely give their time and sometimes even their own investment dollars to be a part of something that you help them to believe in, but that they have a wealth of information on the things that you are not necessarily a subject matter expert at, to help drive this across the finish line.
And I'll add that most of the time, there's like a huge percent of things you should be asking or you should know or acquire, and you don't even know what they are. You don't know what you don't know. And that's where I think there's an aspect of just quantity of time talking to people, advisors and people like you, Mike. And I remember early on, you saying things where it was like, I've never heard that. I never would have thought of it, except I'm here talking to you. I thought we were talking about X, Y, and Z, and now we're talking about something else that you brought up. It's like, you know, and it almost seemed like if not for a quick little discussion I had with certain people, we never would have tried something. Or in fact, one great example, and you were involved, Mike, it might have been JD as well. We were near the end of the fundraise, and I said to JD, who have we not talked to that could be interested? And JD said, I think he said, I'm going to give Mike Caldwell a call, see if we get this in front of the Plains Angels. And it was almost like, if I hadn't asked him that question, and we wouldn't have done it. We ended up getting a sizable amount more of investment because of just that one. What else should we do? You know what I mean? And it's just tremendously valuable. The flip side of that same coin, though, you have to know when to quit listening and go do, right? Because there are 1,000 different opinions. And I know now who, if I ask a question, will say the opposite of someone else. I consider both arguments, but at some point, you got to just go. And maybe you'll make the wrong decision. But you got to know when to, you can't get into that analysis paralysis.
No, and it's not like the scientific method where you have all this great data leading you. It is called mentor whiplash for a reason, and it is whiplash. And a lot of the best thinkers say, go collect data from people you consider really smart, then go make the best decision that you know to make, and don't be influenced by the loudest voice or the person with the most background. Consider it, but don't jump on it.
And there are many people that sound really confident about something. If you really pressure tested a little bit, you find out they just heard this somewhere. It's not much behind it. Yeah, you have to really delve. Tell me why you think that. Otherwise, you can go and think you're doing something. There's just like nothing behind it. So,
and one thing we learned pretty quickly too is you've heard of the law of the 7 degrees of separation. Basically, touches everyone. If there's probably 2 to 3 degrees of separation where you all of a sudden just through us meeting you, Mike, as an example, and you making an introduction to someone else who introduces us to one other person, suddenly your network is huge. And it's understanding who the right people are to go to within that network for very specific needs that is a time efficiency sort of thing, to go to the right people that can help you get to the right answer very quickly is, of course, the path you want. And it's sifting through that broad network to really understand who those experts are and when they can help you.
Well, I think is it Metcalfe's law that says that the power of a network is the square of the number of participants?
I'm not familiar. I like it.
I think it's Metcalfe, but it's from the internet world. And it's from, of course, I'm old enough to, I was around pre-commercial internet. And it was that the power of an internet of a network is the square of the number of people in the network. So you think about moving your number from 4 to 5, you just move the power level from 16 to 25. You guys specifically, and I know enough about your company from my past dealings and involvement, that you have a very, very amazingly gifted cap table of investors. And I call that out because, and you guys listen to them, you talk to them, and you get a feedback. There's too many startups, especially first timers, that kind of just want the money and then get out of my way. You know, give me your money, then I don't want to talk to you anymore. And what they don't realize is what you've been talking about is the amount of advice, but the other thing is the amount of work they'll do. So when you are fundraising, I know some of the people on your board. Not personally, but I know of them. I know their reputations and the heavy lifting they can do with one phone call. And they'll do it, especially when they're an investor and it's economically beneficial to them. You know, what people don't understand is investors are free employees. In fact, we paid you to be an employee.
Very true. And, you know, I think to be a startup founder, and this is almost 6 years into it, you're constantly learning too. So I think every day we're learning how to better utilize our investors and people who are willing to help versus doing the work ourselves. And the flip side to that is also, Todd alluded to this earlier, it's trusting your own instincts when you need to get the biggest dissection or cross-section of information that you can, but you have to make a decision. You're not looking for people to make the decision for you.
Mike, that reminds me, I like to say as well, sometimes everything I learned, everything I need to know, I learned in kindergarten, you know, that book, and people say that a lot. One is you just got to communicate, right? I've had investors ask, how often do you communicate? You know, I've got this other investment. I never hear from them, to what you were saying, Mike. And I'm like, that makes no sense to me. What, you know, so we send out quarterly updates, have an annual meeting, and we make calls. If someone calls me, I call them back. I mean, just simple things that people know that you're responsive and you're on the ball. Because if you're not doing those things, they're wondering, well, what of the more deeper and harder things to do, are you doing those things? And they lose confidence. Yeah. So
it's so sad, because what you do, if you're like that other company that didn't talk at all, when things go bad or when you need help, you know, I'll be frank. I've got some investments where the people refuse to talk to me. They refuse to take my phone call, and I'm an investor. And I think, wow, I really hope you never have to call me up and ask for help or more money, which a lot of times is a really smart investment for an entrepreneur or for an investor is, hey, yeah, they burnt through the money, but now they figured it out. And so now we can really go. And even if it's as bad as recapitalizing a company and writing everything off, that communication is, you know, if you're not communicating because things are going bad, you're missing the point. That's when you want to communicate and communicate more frequently, because those people probably can help you. Probably, again, to your point, they know things you don't.
You know, we had a startup advisor who's actually on our board, who's given us a lot of really good advice over time. And one of the things that he's talked about is people's imagination is pretty powerful. And so if you are giving a possible licensee of our technology a tour, there are certain rooms you can't show them. And that'll make their mind go down miles down the road of what's behind the curtain. And the same is true, I'm sure, of not communicating to your investors and letting their imagination go in terms of just how bad things could be or how the money's being utilized.
Yep.
It goes both ways.
Good point.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a deep communication. The other thing that, because I'll have people say, how do you figure all this stuff out? How do you find all this? How do you know all this stuff? Well, the truth is, I don't. I have a big network, and you guys have been on the other end of this. I will send an email that's a blind email, and sometimes there's 300 people on that email. It says, you know, I'll anonymize the problem. I have a client. Does anybody know how to do X, or somebody that knows X? If not, hit delete. Sorry for the 2-minute interruption. If yes, drop me a note back and see if you could help. And I've had CEOs of big companies reply, people that do not have the time. I mean, honestly, they don't say, yeah, I know that person. I know a person that can do that, or go to this link, read this article, right? And it's the simple act of sending a blind email, which that's pretty easy to do.
Yep, agree.
Interesting.
So PowerPalm today, I mean, when it started out, it was just the two of you. How many employees are in PowerPalm these days?
And we have about 25 full-time employees currently, and it's really been a process of steady growth over time. So if you look at year over year, and it seems like just yesterday where we started with one of our first hires that Todd mentioned that really helped us to develop preservation technology to where we're at today, where you have administrative and HR functions, and of course, key science and key engineering and operations dedication. But yeah, as we stand today, 25 full-time employees, and sometimes we double that in the summer with the part-time staff we bring on to help with both our research and then the operations that we do with our seed company partners.
And if I can ask you to expand on that, they're not all here, not all with you and Iowa, are they?
No, they're not. And thanks for bringing that up, Mike. We actually have a location in Puerto Rico where we have four full-time employees. And right now we're doing travels to Puerto Rico to do a lot of our research over the winter so we can get 12 months of plant growth in Puerto Rico. We'll be in Texas pretty heavily in the May to possibly early June timeframe. We usually cut things off there to get back to the Midwest and really get ready for the season here. And that's going to continue to expand as there's large demand for the technology in Europe as well as South America, America is probably our next destination. So you look at Brazil, Chile, and Argentina, they're all very active with seed production of corn and various and other crops.
One important point to the staff levels is our business model is a licensing and royalty model, which means we're going to transfer the technology to our customers, and they either do it or we find a service provider to do it for them. So it means that we don't have to expend the huge expense of building a service industry ourselves. And the employees that do it are either hired within the seed company or a service provider. So that's helped to keep that need for more employees down. Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about what you guys have learned, but if you were just to sit back and think, okay, you both did time in corporate America, large corp, and you know it well, and you were successful in that area. What have you learned over the years from Power Pollen, especially contrasting what you learned in corporate America? You guys are, you're not as old as I am, but you're not 25. You have substantial experience in the world. And so you come to this 5 years ago with a lot of knowledge, and you'd have every right to think, hey, I really know a lot. But I'm curious now that it's been, well, you're coming up on 6 years. What have you learned?
You know, I think we'll both have answers for this that might vary a little bit just because all of our own experiences or individual journeys. For me, the thing you learn really rapidly in a startup is sometimes the things you were trying to do in big business to begin with. And that's that agility and the really dynamic response to technology needs. My job's always been in developing new technologies that have a place. You're not inventing it, waiting for someone to come. You're trying to fill a real gap or a void that exists within industry. And so when you have that sort of all of a sudden great freedom, so to speak, to develop these things, it requires a level of focus that is difficult. You have to really commit, even though you have a lot of other really good ideas, commit to the ones that get you towards producing revenue. And you also learn pretty quickly that that supporting network that you took for granted, whether it be accounting or HR or all these other aspects of business, suddenly they're not there. And in a small startup, when you first begin, you're all those things. You might be terrible at some of them, but you know, you took it for granted before. And now it's like, okay. And each night I need to order things off the internet and from suppliers for the work that we need to do. Or in Todd's case early on, it was doing the accounting and making sure all the bills are paid along with all the other duties.
Yeah, I still regularly empty a trash can if it's full, or go out into the warehouse and grab more paper towels and restock the bathrooms or whatever. And I think everyone should do that anyway, even in a big company, if there's something needed, but in particular, the small company, you just have to. So those are good points, Jason. I'll throw a few others. The satisfaction of a close connection of your decisions and what you do with the success of the business or lack thereof is super satisfying. But it also, when it's not the right decision, and we have examples, the result is you've got to have way more grit and endurance than you had at the big company. At the big company, you know, I was involved in some ways, and Jason was too, on many multiple projects. And any one of those could have failed. Well, we got other ones that are working out, right? Okay, so 2 out of 10 didn't work, or whatever the number is. There's other ones, it kind of, okay, I'm not sweating it that much, right? You still might have been upset about it. But here we have really, like I said, we have one, maybe two first place things to do. That's it. One of them has a problem. Yep. It takes a lot more grit and endurance than I've ever realized. And, you know, I started the company with Jason when I was 48. It's been the best thing for me, for my ambition, my health overall. Just it's been a great thing. But there's a lot of things that you learn.
It really causes you to think about stress a little different too. Stress in a larger organization, a lot of times it's the expectations of this large system and things you're supposed to do to comply. And stress in a startup has many different forms, but it's been a healthier stress in that you really see where you're driving this technology, and it helps to keep you honest and in terms of those deliverables. And, you know, I think the last part that's really cool for us is, since it's a small company, you can grow a really healthy culture, and you're responsible for that culture. And, you know, if you ask a lot of our employees, I think they'll tell you that they really enjoy our culture. Most of them came from large companies, and they want to keep that culture intact because we're a very close-knit family. And frankly, we spend a lot of hours working together. So, you know, you want it to be family-like in that sense. And that's a responsibility, really, when it comes down to it at the end of the day, is to make sure you're not ignoring the health of the organization around you, because at the end of the day, you are side by side with them driving for the success that everyone wants.
Yeah. Maybe I'll throw in one more thing too. This is more practical for your listeners probably, Mike. I very early on got interested in how we assess risk, and there's some articles out there on it. I think one of the things I learned is, and there's a lot of topics around risk, but one of the things I learned is that as humans, we tend to overestimate the downside of risk. And to the very word risk, we automatically want to eliminate all risks. In reality, in most of the time, we should be thinking about what's the upside that you're trying to get at that brings the risk with it. And you could completely maybe ignore the risk. Just make sure you're focused on the success. And that is the best risk mitigator. But there are many, many, many things, I think, that should be done that don't get done because people just want to avoid all risk. And I think it's a 10x problem in a bigger corporate environment compared to a small company environment. And that's why the efficiencies are so much higher in a small company environment.
And it comes back to culture, because the big company culture is punish failure. And the small company culture, the startup culture, is, I won't say reward failure, but learn from failure. I watched my company, which got very, very large. We're close to $1 billion a year. They changed out their president. And the guy that, and they're both people that had been with the company a long time, long history of the company. And the first president that was let go for whatever reason, I think it was he's doing good, but he's not doing good enough, was a risk taker. And he understood that not everything worked. The second guy that came in was not a risk taker. And he said to a lot of, and he said it to me too. He said, "You believe in this project?" "Yeah." "You willing to bet your job on it?" "Yep." "That's good, because I'm going to fire you if it doesn't work." When he did that, and this was a tech company, so we had 600 engineers, productivity shut down. And everybody just hid in their desk, right? It's like, I'm keeping my head down, because you knew you're going to lose your job. And, you know, I get the idea of what he was trying to get at, that you want people to believe in what they do. But, you know, the thing that I think encourages a lot of people with startups is failure isn't terminal for your job career. And we all know it's not going to work right. It's like the investors. We know you're going to, it's to your point where you started out, it took longer than we thought. We already knew that, right? And so I get it. Well, guys, this has been a lot of fun to talk. I wish you well going forward. You guys have already created a lot of success, and I know there's still more to do, but I want to thank you both for joining me today. And if there's anything else you'd like to say before we close it out, that'd be great.
Yeah, well, it's our pleasure to meet with you. We appreciate it, Mike. We appreciate all you've done for us. And, you know, maybe to your listeners, those who are thinking about being an entrepreneur and starting a small company, is we highly recommend it. It's no more risk than staying in a big job, a big company job. It necessarily depends on how you measure the risk. And, you know, I love it. It's great to be here. I love what I'm doing. And if this company is successful, I think I'll do it again.
Yeah, I would agree, Todd. Mike, thank you very much for your time. And, you know, I think I'd summarize for your listeners, startups is sometimes that solution to really wanting to achieve things and make technology happen just at an expedited rate that gives you a real satisfaction of, okay, this is the type of progress I've always really wanted to make. Now I have an outlet to do it.
Well, Jason Cope and Todd Krohn, thank you for being on Startup Stories.
Thanks for listening to the Small Business and Startup Stories DSM podcast. Inspired by these stories, we offer a hub full of resources needed for any small business owner to grow and succeed in Greater Des Moines, Iowa at dsmpartnership.com/smallbusiness. Thanks for listening.